This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
They said, don't go there. Bad things happen, but money and power. We still go to the limit we are living.
We lost the climate gamble. Now what? As the world hits record extreme cold and heat, even in December, leading scientists finally admit, so what comes after failure? From the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, you get the latest update in a full-length presentation by Professor James Dyke. First, a few notes on the estimates of what to expect this year and next in the climate casino. Yeah, welcome to an astonishing finish to 2025. North America is split into simultaneous extreme heat and cold. The lower 48 states easily broke the record for the warmest Christmas ever recorded by a margin of 5 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 3 degrees C. On Christmas Day, Denver, Colorado experienced a high of 71 degrees Fahrenheit, 22 C. It was summer-like t-shirt weather, a mile high, 1,600 meters into the mountains on Christmas. Dallas was 81 Fahrenheit. As America was roasting, not the turkey, but outside, our listeners in Canada's Yukon Territory continued their weeks of amazing cold. On December 23rd, Braeburn, Yukon recorded minus 55.7 C, that's minus 68 Fahrenheit. This is the coldest temperature recorded in December across Canada since 1975. The Yukon is about the size of Spain with a population of around 45,000 people. Most of them, about 33,000, live in the capital city of Whitehorse. Weeks of extreme cold make it dangerous to go outside with unprotected skin. To keep everyone and everything warm, including all the car block heaters and the pipes and all that, the past few weeks of extreme cold took the Yukon perilously close to its peak possible electrical loads. They hit the limits. On December 23rd, the government warned the population, saying, "We set an all-time peak demand record of 123 megawatts. This exceeded the previous record set just a few weeks ago. In ideal conditions, with everything running at maximum, our system can produce about 140 megawatts. The government is renting diesel generators to cope. A shout-out to freezing listeners in the Yukon. Radio EcoShock is broadcast there by CJUC 92.5 FM in Whitehorse and CFET in Tagish. A string of meteorologists and weather watchers are blown away by this huge contrast, over 150 degrees Fahrenheit or 83 degrees C on the same continent, without even counting the tropics. A similar split between excruciating cold and unseasonal heat is hovering between Siberia and Central Asia. These extremes are blamed on waves of the jet stream altered by climate change. We are setting up for an extreme future.
Go no further, no further to go. Speed and space, time and place. Got the limit.
So what should we expect in the next couple of years? Maps of the ocean temperature show very little warming in the southern hemisphere and definite cooling around the tropics and into the North Pacific and Atlantic Ocean. This follows 3 years of record-setting sea surface temperatures. Ocean surface temperatures are the main driver establishing what you and I experience on land. According to Carbon Brief, quote, in 2023, global temperatures reached a new high, after they significantly exceeded expectations. This record was surpassed in 2024, the first year where average global temperatures were above 1.5 degrees C, above pre-industrial levels. Now, 2025 is set to be the second or third warmest year on record, end quote. At Berkeley, research scientist Zeke Hausfather neatly wraps up some predictions for 2026 and 27. The UK Met Office recently released their 2026 prediction, estimating that it is most likely to end up as the second warmest year on record at 1.46 C, with a range of about 1.34 C and 1.58 C, relative, of course, to the 1850-1900 pre-industrial baseline. This is likely warmer than both 2023 and 2025, with a small chance of being warmer than 2024. Not to be outdone, James Hansen, the famous NASA scientist, released his estimate that 2026 temperatures will also be around 1.47 C, albeit using a somewhat different 1880 to 1920 baseline. Hansen also adds a prediction for 2027 at 1.7 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial, although he refers to the 12-month warming during the year rather than the annual average per se. The prediction is based on an assumed El Niño developing in late 2026, something that models have suggested is increasingly likely in recent weeks. And what is Zeke Hausfather's own prediction? For 2026, I expect global temperatures to be around 1.4 degrees C with a 95% confidence. This means that it is almost certain to be one of the top four warmest years, but quite unlikely to exceed 2024's record. Global temperatures in 2026 will be slightly suppressed by modest La Niña conditions in the tropical Pacific early in the year, while a late developing El Niño, if it occurs, will primarily affect 2027 temperatures. That's from Zeke Hausfather. European climate nerd Jan Umsonst does not expect any record-setting global temperatures in the next couple of years. Comparing the ocean to a capacitor, which builds up energy until it discharges heat, he says the oceans need some years of additional heat uptake to recharge the oscillator, which are the global oceans. He continues, ocean surface temperatures dropped by some 0.3 degrees C in the last months. It's the amount sea surface temperatures increased from 2023 to 2024 and lasting into this year. This would then imply that the next temperature jump can only happen in several years, as even an El Niño in 2026-27 should not be able to raise sea surface temperatures far above previous record values, end quote. So, folks, we must give up the idea that global warming is a steady escalator with record years, one right after the other, as you see on so many official graphs. The public could expect new records every year and weaken in their climate resolve if we encounter anything lower than that. People don't tend to pay attention if it's not a record, but it's still getting hotter. In November, respected European scientists James Dyke and Johan Rockström admit the world has lost the climate gamble. The safety line of 1.5 degrees C of warming is behind us. Following the new report, Living Beyond Limits, James Dyke laid it all out in a clear lecture December 10, 2025, at the University of Exeter in the UK. James is Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute. Here it is.
So what are we doing here today? Well, I'm going to talk about a paper, but I'm going to ruthlessly editorialize this. So it was, as I will show you, it was a very large number of co-authors, but I'm going to tell you what they either do think or they should think about this paper. It was work that came out of the Earth League. The Earth League, it's an international collaboration of organizations. The University of Exeter, the Global Systems Institute, is a member. And we convened earlier this year in June in Hamburg, and it was reflecting on essentially 10 years since the Paris Agreement. So the Paris Agreement, 2015, it's its 10th anniversary coming up later this month. And it's a diverse community, and we wanted to consider, well, what has been the progress since the Paris Agreement, and what does that progress or lack of progress mean in terms of climate change and what's becoming increasingly commonly known as overshoot? So the title of the paper, Living Beyond Limits, Consequences. I was very keen to get consequences in the title, right? Consequences are missing the decisive decade for preserving our planet's life-supporting systems. It's been 5 minutes to midnight for the last 30 years or so, right? And surely we can take the opportunity of 10 years after Paris and the imminent extinction of the available carbon budget for 1.5 to reflect on what has been a not just 10 years, but decades of failure. That's the paper that emerged, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Subsequent to that, Johan and I wrote an article, a much shorter article for The Conversation. We don't write the title, but the editors thought the title of The World Lost the Climate Gamble, Now It Faces a Dangerous New Reality. And I will be talking about gambling and risk in some ways later, because I think at the heart of this issue is this notion of risk. Risk of what? How are we managing this risk? Okay, so some disclaimers. I do not represent the views of anybody else, certainly not my co-authors, or my institute or university. And, of course, all errors and omissions are mine alone. So the talk summary, what am I going to tell you, right? Well, spoiler alert, we failed to stop the dangerous interference in the Earth system, and you know that already. But this failure has got consequences, and we are still working out what these consequences are going to be. I think in response of that, in response to that, the primary objective of climate research and policy is to manage these consequences. We can't live in la-la land anymore, this kind of fantastical bend the curve, everything's going to be fine, we're going to recover from overshoot. There are going to be very long-term and serious consequences of our failure to stop our dangerous interference in the climate system. One of those risks and the things that we're going to need to think about are what I call derailment risks, and I'll explain those later. And an associated risk is this kind of technocentric approach in further attempting to interfere with the Earth system, with the climate system, we could actually compound risks and make the situation potentially much, much worse. Okay, so the Paris talks in 2015. Yay, right? I don't know if anyone was around or engaged in climate advocacy or science at the moment. This was a very, very rare high point in which the international community in COP21, the 21st conference of the party, finally agreed what dangerous climate change was, and that it was well below 2 degrees Celsius, and that all nations would have a legal obligation to do whatever is required in order to limit warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Subsequent to that, I mean, I would argue in 2021 in Glasgow, well below has become understood as 1.5 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial periods. And there's a number of reasons why 1.5 is important. Back in the Paris Agreement 10 years ago, the narrative is that 1.5 is an existential risk to those people and places most vulnerable to climate change, low-lying island nation states, people who might live in river deltic areas that don't really have any credible form of adaptation from sea level rise, people in lower level or lower latitudes that will be subject to increasing severity of water insecurity or extreme weather events such as heat waves. Since then, however, we've had a decade of development of tipping point science, much of which has come out of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. And now I think it's fair to say that 1.5 represents a potentially serious risk to some of the world's richest nations in terms of assets, in terms of liability, in terms of lost coastline, but then also in terms of morbidity and mortality. So 1.5 is important. It matters, right? Now, back in 2015, there were not any credible plans to actually completely decarbonize our societies. And there's a number of reasons for that. The polite society reason is that there will be some industries that are hard to decarbonize. There are no credible alternatives to burning kerosene in wide-bodied commercial aircraft at the moment. There are commercial electric aircraft, right? But there's nothing like the scale of the kerosene burning fleet at the moment. So that's not going to be decarbonized in time. But then also you've got industrial processes, cement manufacturing, steel manufacturing, which while we can see how their emissions could be significantly reduced, there's no credible plan how we're going to turn these industries around at the pace of scale that we need in order to actually manage these carbon budgets for 1.5.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Dr. James Dyke, speaking at the University of Exeter on December 10th. The lecture is called Living Beyond Limits, following a new report of the same name.
So this is how I explain the origins of net zero. It is still the case that when we talk about climate policy, we talk about net zero. In fact, net zero has become synonymous with climate policy. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case, right? But now it's net zero. And what net zero is meant to do, it's meant to include not just carbon dioxide, but other greenhouse gas emissions, in particular methane, within science-based targets on emissions reductions, as opposed to relying solely on offsetting. But this idea that we reach net zero when essentially the amount of carbon we put into the Earth's atmosphere each year is balanced by the amount of carbon that we somehow remove each year. And that is driven by this notion of budgets. The amount of warming that we've got right now is, in some respects, a remarkably simple function of cumulative emissions since the large-scale burning of fossil fuels. And the more carbon dioxide we put into the Earth's atmosphere, the more warming we're going to see, because it increases the radiative forcing. That carbon dioxide stays radiatively active. It stays in the atmosphere for a very long time. So there's this kind of simple equation. You want to limit warming to a certain amount. You need to limit the amount of total carbon cumulative emissions. And that ends up producing a carbon budget. So here's a little animation courtesy of the Global Carbon Budget. Gosh, that's another Global Systems Institute project that I've just mentioned. It's titled Time is Up for Staying Below 1.5, because there's kind of a simple arithmetic that as the years go by and the cumulative emissions increase, which produces an increase in the average surface temperature of the Earth, you end up reaching a point when essentially that budget is gone. And now we estimate it to be about, 6% left, and it could be exceeded within, let's say, 4 years. Well, it depends on who you ask. I'm not going to talk too much around some of the competing theories around the what appears to be acceleration in the rate of warming. Maybe I will, just to upset Peter, who sat at the back. But what we can say definitively is that carbon budget is nearly gone. So here's some work from Piers et al. Earlier this year reflecting on carbon budgets. They estimate the 50% carbon budget is going to be exhausted in 28. It's worth bearing in mind that previous IPCC assessment reports, they didn't give 50% probabilities. It was like 66, 2 and 3. For a 66% chance of limiting warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, you won't really see those budgets reported anymore because they're not policy relevant, because the carbon budget would be exhausted probably within a matter of months now. So now we're back to 50%. And when 50% is gone, then I guess we could go to 40% or 30% or 25%. There are still significant uncertainties with regards to the climate's response to our radiative forcing. And let's remember, we need to put this into context, into a wider context. Here we've got 10,000 years of carbon dioxide as reported by Berkeley Earth, and it's this spike since large-scale industrial processes. What is it, 2.5 trillion tons, over 2.5 trillion tons of carbon dioxide that we have put into the Earth's atmosphere since industrial processes, but over half of that has been emitted since 1990, right? So since the UNFCCC started in earnest, since COP1. So over half the cumulative emissions we put into the atmosphere has happened on the watch of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that almost entirely, along with natural variation, which you've got a reasonably good understanding of, accounts for the increase in global temperature anomaly. Berkeley Earth last year had it exceeding 1.5. It's actually 1.6 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial periods. This does not mean that global warming has exceeded 1.5 or 1.6, because you need a longer baseline. You need 20 years to really zero out natural variability in order. You need to zero out that natural variability to be able to detect the long-term trend. But with both the increase in surface temperatures and the vanishing carbon budget, I don't think there's really any doubt that 1.5 is gone. But I did mention earlier that the rate of climate change or global warming has been increasing over the last 10 years. This is from an article from Carbon Brief. I think it was last year that they did a special on this. Zeke contributed, a whole bunch of other climate scientists contributed. And it was kind of this discussing, well, you know, for a while, some people, most notably Jim Hansen, previous director of NASA Goddard, has been arguing that the rate of increase of temperatures is much faster. It's been accelerating, maybe even up to twice as fast as previous decades. And why is that? And there's been a whole bunch of competing theories and arguments. even dispute that this is a statistically significant signal. And it is absolutely the case that we would need longer in order to determine if that was the case. But I think it's fair to say that there is increasing consensus that the reduction in aerosol forcing, the reduction in high sulfur content burning coal and maybe even marine shipping could have been reduced the global dimming effect that we have inadvertently been producing on the climate, and therefore in some respects unmasking the amount of radiative forcing we're producing through greenhouse gases. And Jim calls it this kind of Faustian bargain that we've been playing with the climate system. Jim is also much more hawkish on climate sensitivity. So when you add in that factor, and when you add in the factor that Jim tends to not be very polite about contemporary climate modelling, I think it's fair to say, he bases his assessments much more on kind of paleo data, on historical data. When you do that, then his assessment of the actual amount of warming that we've got, given cumulative emissions, is much, much higher than you would see in, let's say, even in like the CMIP 6 models. Anyway, back to one side. I would argue you don't need Jim to be right to be freaking out. You don't need Jim to be correct about aerosols and acceleration for us to conclude that 1.5 is gone and serious consequences are in the pipeline. And just to remind us that an average increase of 1.5 or 1.6 degrees Celsius a year above that in terms of pre-industrial periods means potentially very significant annual temperature anomalies up to 5-6 degrees Celsius, and you see most of this in the higher latitudes, a process called Arctic amplification, and also Europe, which is pretty much the fastest warming continent for reasons, which are kind of interesting, and I don't entirely understand them. But these are average anomalies, and of course, the concerns that we've got about climate change is not changes in averages, but the changes in extremes. So these averages, average anomalies are being driven by, in some places, extremely high temperatures. So the 1.5 budget is gone. I know there was an awful lot of scepticism at the time that 1.5 was ever credible given existing political realities, let's say, given existing political, maybe even economic systems. But this showed for a 66% chance. This is from Robbie's work back after the Paris Agreement kind of was being agreed. Even for a 66% chance, you'd see the longer that you leave it, the more and more heroic your rates of mitigation become. Put, let's say, 4% reductions into kind of context. During COVID lockdowns, there was periods in which global emissions were being reduced at a rate of maybe 6 or 7% or something. So in order to produce anything like the rate of change required for 1.5, you'd have to be either shuttering significant regions of the global economy or doing something else quite radical to our industrialized societies. But 1.5 is still alive, right? That's what you hear. That's every COP you go to. That's what we say. We've got to stay the course. The Paris Agreement hasn't failed. We can still limit warming to 1.5. That's because net zero is transitioning to overshoot. So I say here that net zero relies on overshoot. Net zero, 1.5 relies on overshoot. 1.5 has always relied on overshoot. There's always been this understanding within the Paris Agreement that we're going to exceed 1.5, but then hopefully temperatures will be dragged back down by the end of the century. And they're going to do that because around 2050, when we reach net zero, we're going to transition to a period of net negative. So we're going to be removing more and more carbon dioxide from the Earth's atmosphere than we put into it. And in doing so, reduce cumulative emissions and therefore reduce warming. And I will talk a little bit more about that. I don't want to talk too much about it because I've talked about it an awful lot in the past. But let's just take a moment to reflect on where we are right now. There are lots of people who don't think climate change is real for a whole bunch of probably motivated reasons, right? Ask the insurance industry. They'll tell you because these are the people, these are the organizations on the hook for paying for climate-related extreme weather impact events. $162 billion this year. Climate catastrophes are creating a new market reality for insurance carriers. One way to interpret that is that there will be some places which become literally uninsurable because the premiums cannot be afforded. No insurer wants to take that risk. Costs pile up as climate change adds $600 billion in insurance losses. We see rising heat deaths. This is one of the easier ways to determine climate change impacts on morbidity and mortality, because the warmer it gets, the more likely you're going to get extreme weather events such as lethal heat waves. So the rate of heat-related mortality has increased by nearly a quarter since the 1990s. We're seeing increasing wildfire and drought impacts, and that is having a non-trivial impact on economic strain. Productivity losses equivalent to maybe $1 trillion. The costs of heat-related deaths among adults reaching $261 billion. This is safe climate change. This is acceptable climate change. This is the decision that society, through its either elected politicians or the politicians that come to govern those systems or nation states, have determined is acceptable in the context of how much greenhouse gases can be put into the atmosphere to produce this amount of warming. And none of this should be a surprise. There is, I think, quite compelling work that in many respects we have potentially seriously underestimated the distribution of risks and therefore how much economic loss, how much morbidity or mortality might be in the pipeline. But these numbers, in some respects, shouldn't surprise anyone. This is just the unavoidable consequence of living in a climate system which has become significantly warm over a geologically instant timescale. Yes, the climate's changed a lot in the past. You know, we've got 3.8 billion years of history of life on Earth, and some of the most intense mass extinction events have been associated with climate change, but probably nothing like this has happened in terms of radiative forcing, either for millions and millions of years or perhaps even ever, right? So this is really exceptional. So we're transitioning from net zero into overshoot. And yes, maybe Paris Agreement was always about overshoot, because you would never have gotten the United States, you would have never gotten even the United Kingdom, which is meant to be a progressive, forward-thinking climate nation, to agree to doing the things that would really have been required to manage the carbon budget for 1.5 even below 2 degrees Celsius in 2015. The United States would never have signed up for the required rapid decarbonisation. So it was all about on-ramps. We could offset through nature-based solutions, forests, carbon sinks. We can invoke technologies, carbon capture, storage, carbon dioxide removal. We can kind of taper the curve such that we will arrive at a safe place after we've overshot by a bit down by the end of the century. So the architects of the Paris Agreement were extremely clever on how they crafted that agreement. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for their efforts in being able to produce what has been still humanity's best efforts at avoiding dangerous climate change. But how are we going to do that, right? How are we going to drag temperatures back down? Well, I call it the wacky races. If you've got an idea to remove a large amount of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then you just go knock like a philanthropic fund and they might give you, I don't know, a few million or something. And yes, that does sound incredibly better because I've tried it myself and it has not worked yet. But how would they do that? So there's a number of different ranges and approaches. On the top here, we've got so-called nature-based solutions, some of which just seem to be little regrets options. They seem to be generally good ideas. Let's take biochar. You take agricultural waste, farm waste, the waste that's left over from, let's say, threshing wheat or something, and you turn it into charcoal, process of pyrolysis, locks up that carbon in that biomass, and then you can put that biomass high in carbon back on the land to increase productivity and locks a significant amount of carbon up. You can undergo tree planting. This could be reforestation, so planting trees which used to exist through a process of maybe habitat restoration, or afforestation, where you plant very large areas with typically fast-growing alien species, which might not be very good for biodiversity. You can reduce the pH of the ocean, reduce carbon dioxide concentrations directly in the ocean, and taking carbon dioxide directly out of the sea, that doesn't seem to be a tremendously bad idea either. You can accelerate the silicate weathering cycle by essentially grinding up mountains and then spreading those minerals on crop fields, which would accelerate the kind of natural process in which carbon dioxide reacts with water to produce weak acids, which then react with the minerals to lock up carbon dioxide. You could undertake ocean fertilization, which has been attempted badly in the past and not gone very well, but the idea of overcome nutrient limitation in the top portions of the ocean that would produce algal blooms, which when they die would draw that carbon down to the bottom of the sea, or what is where an awful lot of money is going today in engineered removals, direct air capture. This is an artist's impression. Imagine vast arrays of kind of air conditioning units which suck carbon dioxide directly out of the atmosphere. That gas is compressed and then pumped deep underground, probably into, not exclusively, but probably into depleted oil and gas fields where it will stay forever.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to UK Professor James Dyke, laying out the harsh truth of warming beyond the safe zone, where we are, and what it means. This lecture was recorded at the University of Exeter on December 10th, 2025, and is rebroadcast with permission.
This is a bit of a snark. Better late than never. It's been relatively late that the climate science community, the earth science community, the people who are involved in thinking about carbon budgets have made it really quite unambiguously clear that a lot of the approaches or maybe assumptions around overshoot are not very credible, right? There is overconfidence in our ability to be able to remove large amounts of carbon dioxide. Sustainability are needed because if you undergo large-scale afforestation, probably as part of BECCS, bioenergy carbon capture and storage, you could threaten water security, food security, you could displace people from the land, you could decimate biodiversity. There could be a whole bunch of bad things that could result from that attempted climate solution. There is over-reliance on land for carbon dioxide removal. When you add up all the land, just simply in terms of land surface, there just doesn't seem to be enough to be able to take out what could be heroic amounts of carbon dioxide. And this means there is essentially a carbon dioxide removal gap. And I would say to this just very briefly, what do you think policymakers would do if you provided them with an option to not undergo rapid mitigation, but propose future technological solutions that will recover us back into a safe climate? This should surprise nobody. And it is quite interesting how it has been relatively late that the academic community has, through important work, been making clear that some of the promises of overshoot may not be delivered. There's other ways to think about this conceptually. I always like the work of David Ho. He's a US geoscientist who imagines carbon dioxide removal as a sort of time machine, right? So if you think about cumulative emissions determine total amount of warming, and those emissions have built up over time, well, carbon dioxide removal is trying to go back in time to unwind some of those emissions. And the point that David makes through this analogy is that our ability to go back in time is currently extraordinarily feeble. If you're looking at engineered emissions, if you take a year's worth of greenhouse carbon dioxide emissions, which is the best part of 40 billion tons a year, over that entire year, we're maybe able to wind the clock back maybe a few minutes or something, right? It just doesn't have any meaningful impact. The other analogy that I would suggest we think about this is in terms of parachutes. This idea that a parachute is a safety device. It can save your life, or in this case, it's safely arresting some kind of payload down to Earth. But parachutes can only work at certain speeds. If you try and put something that is far too heavy on that parachute, it accelerates the parachute and the parachute has become impaired, damaged, it will rip, and then it's about as much use as a chocolate fire guard. Right? So these technologies have a purpose, they have a potential role, but it has to be in the context of decarbonisation. So the way that David describes it, yes, we could deploy CDR, but CDR is only really going to make sense once we've done the bulk of our decarbonisation. Supposing that it can somehow offset 40 billion tonnes a year is just dangerously uninformed. So that's the climate system. In some respects, that's the good news, because the bad news is that the Earth system is responding to human impacts, not just in terms of it's getting warmer, heat waves are increasing, but there is perhaps evidence that elements of the Earth system is losing resilience, is becoming less able to deal with anthropogenic forcing. So what this video shows It's a visualization of carbon dioxide emissions. So CO2 is a well-mixed gas. Doesn't really matter where you emit it, but you can see these points here. These are individual power stations, right? And it's well-mixed. So it doesn't matter if it happens in Baltimore or Birmingham or Bangalore, that carbon dioxide will eventually migrate its way throughout the entire planet. But this is what I'm particularly interested in. This pulsing, this is showing the day-night cycle, and it's the drawing down of carbon dioxide during the day and then respiring carbon dioxide out through these significant areas of terrestrial vegetation, for example, the Asian and the sub-Saharan African rainforests. It's this cycling of carbon through days, through months, through years, and over long timescales, which has been importantly buffering up our emissions of greenhouse gases. So you probably already know about half of all the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere each year, about 40 billion tons, half of it ends up in the sea or on land. So about a quarter in the land and a quarter in the sea. If those natural carbon sinks start to fail, if they start to slow down the amount of carbon dioxide they remove from the atmosphere, or in some place even begin to put carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere through outgassing, we go for a situation where it becomes a sink to a source, then the challenge we've got when it comes to carbon dioxide removal becomes much, much more serious. So I'm thinking about now the planetary perspective. So one of the things we were very mindful of when we met in June was the planetary boundaries concept, because our lead author for this paper was Johan Rockström, and Johan has pioneered the application and development of the planetary boundaries framework. Here it is in 2009, and it imagined you've got these various dimensions of the Earth system. You've got climate change, yes, biosphere integrity, land system change, freshwater use, biogeochemical flows, ocean acidification, atmospheric aerosol loading, stratospheric ozone depletion, and novel entities. And human impacts are radiating out, such if we're in the circle, we're in this kind of safe zone. And as you're going further from this kind of circle, we're entering the increasing zone of uncertainty and then into the danger zone. And back in 2009, the big ones were biosphere integrity, just a simple result of land use change, ecosystem destruction, biodiversity loss. Whatever the rate of biodiversity loss or species loss was before humans, it's probably much, much higher now, maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands higher, tens of thousands times higher than the background extinction rate. Climate change was, of course, a concern, but then also biogeochemical flows, the sheer amount of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer that we put on the ground on farmlands, which is having a devastating impact on aquatic ecosystems. Well, as the years have gone by, the number of boundaries that have been assessed to have crossed have increased. So we are today in 25. We determined that there are about 9 boundaries been assessed, and 7 of those are crossed. Biosphere integrity is being broken up into terms of functional biodiversity, of genetic, which is kind of simple and a measure of the total numbers of species. Novel entities is of serious risk because of the increasing number of industrial processes, the new species of chemicals that we're producing that we have really no idea about. Things like PFAS or plastics, microplastics has been really capturing people's attention. And climate change in terms of CO2 concentrations and radiative forcing. So we're going backwards, right? Or forwards in the wrong direction. So this is what we wanted to talk about. And the way that we considered we're going to visualize that is this. And this is a complicated picture, and I don't have much time, but I will do my best. We've got this kind of idea of a planetary boundary safe and just space. We were kind of still well within it in 1997, the Kyoto Protocol, and we could have turned back then, right? There were some bold promises made by the international community about stopping the dangerous interference. There was a whole series of missed opportunities, and then something of maybe of a reset in 2015. We could have turned round, but we didn't. We have what we call this missed decade of climate action. So here we are now in 2025, where we need to undertake a rapid, radical pivot in order to meet our sustainable development goals, many of which are stalling or even going in reverse. So that's not good. But turn this thing around such that we recover back into a safe space, which is going to have to be net negative somehow by the end of the century. If we continue exceeding these planetary boundaries, then we get to this point of a critical juncture with this idea of a planetary threshold tipping points. I'll talk about those briefly in a moment. And then when we were developing this figure, I said, no, look, it's not a discrete threshold, right? It's going to be increasing kind of a graduated range of risk. So don't make this a solid line. So the designer came back, okay, I'll make little dots in it. Okay, fine. But it's the idea that there is this kind of this notion of a critical juncture, which I try to capture with the notion of derailment risk that I'll talk about later, where if we can't turn things around, it becomes increasingly likely that we just end up making things even worse. So up here, we've got social unrest, failure to meet SDGs, generally very bad, not just Earth system, not just bad climate outcomes, but bad social outcomes, because we would have failed to both arrest warming, arrest the exceedance of other planetary boundaries, and also fail to meet our sustainable development goals. What this is, in some respect, is kind of an overshoot. And an overshoot, you should be expecting a correction. So none of this is new. The first world conference on the, not just the climate, but the Earth system, the human environment, was back in 1972. 1972 was also the date of publication of the famous, infamous book, Limits to Growth, of which popularized this notion that we could exceed boundaries, we could exceed limits, and if you do that, then you're going to undertake a correction, and that correction could be interpreted as some kind of extremely bad outcome for society, maybe some kind of collapse. So us saying somehow we've exceeded this notion of a safe space, we've exceeded boundaries, therefore there might be some kind of extremely unpleasant consequence in the pipeline, is nothing new in some respects. So enter overshoot plus. So we've had net zero, we've had overshoot, and now we're entering the region of overshoot plus, I would argue, because if you are paying attention, you can see this narrative is now increasing. So overshoot plus has us think that temperature exceeds this threshold, whether it's 1.5 or 2, or maybe within a planetary threshold, with the deployment of CDR, carbon dioxide removal, will be dragging temperatures down. But in the meantime, we have geoengineering, which is going to shave off maximum temperatures. So this is some work that I've been progressing with Mandy Bissett. And the starting point was a recent paper by Hyslop that referred back to some older work. So I did not know back that John Shepherd came up with this, co-authored the napkin, what's called the napkin diagram, because apparently they scrawled on the back of a napkin. And what it shows is how increases in temperature could be, in some respects, managed or regulated through a portfolio of approaches, right? So here we are now, and here we are 200 years into the future. So one thing I want to point out right away is that Overshoot Plus is making the assumption that we are going to be doing things not just for years or decades, but centuries. So this is a multi-generational project we've set ourselves. Here we've got business as usual. Well, we don't want that because we're going to have temperatures sometime around the end of this century, which is kind of 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial periods, and that's catastrophic. So what we'll do is we'll take mitigation, which is this curve. But mitigation is assumed to only be able to reduce warming by so much. So you add in CDR, this curve, well, that's going to apply a reducing factor, right? But it's SRM, solar radiation management, which you need because you can scale that pretty quickly such that we can limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius. And then with adaptation, we can even take it down even further so that the consequence of the amount of warming is not so that it produces a level of impact or suffering that are considered to be unacceptable, right? Mitigate, CDR, SRM, that's the approach. And how are we going to do that? Well, the most of the action at the moment is in solar radiation management. There is some cloud thinning as well, but the main attempt is to reduce the amount of energy that's received on the surface of the Earth from the sun, right? And how are we going to do that? Well, we could increase surface albedo, the brightness, so marine cloud brightening, make very highly reflective bubbles and clouds. Most of the interest seems to be much higher up in the atmosphere towards the higher portions of the troposphere. stratospheric aerosol injection. If you inject sulfurous compounds into the high portions of the atmosphere, it mimics the actions of a large volcanic eruption. There have been eruptions, most noticeably Pinatubo in the early 90s, that had a global cooling effect for a few years of maybe up to half a degree Celsius. If we replicate that by flying millions of sorties of wide-bodied aircraft that have been converted into tankers and then spray these sulfurous compounds, then we could have an immediate cooling effect. It won't do anything in terms of carbon dioxide concentrations, it won't do anything in terms of ocean acidification, but it would buy us vital time in order for us to be able to recover back into safety. That's the plan. And I think this is the plan you're going to hear an awful lot more about as temperatures and impacts increase. But here's the thing about overshoot. In much of the overshoot discourse, it's assumed to be a temporary and a recoverable from. But there's nothing about the definition of the term. Overshoot just means to go past an intended stopping or turning point inadvertently. We overshot something. And overshooting is, in some contexts, extremely serious. Overshooting a runway excursion, produces significant damage. It could, we would be talking about millions of dollars to fix that airframe, not to mention what other kind of insurance costs you're going to get. The airframe could be entirely lost because of the overshoot, and there could also be associated loss of life. So this is the recent 29th of December, 24. Feels more recent than that. A flight from Bangkok that was landing in South Korea undertook an overshoot, and there is a video that shows the crash. So depending on how you feel about such things, I mean, just don't look at the video. You can't see anyone, but it's obviously a plane crashing. I want to show the plane crashing because it is important to see the conditions of the actual incident, right? The thing to bear in mind here is that the landing gear is not down, the flaps are not set, the aircraft is clearly not configured to land, and it's sliding along the entire length of the runway, but it's what happens there. So the story appears to be that the aircraft was coming into land and there was a bird strike. It flew through a flock of migrating ducks. It took out one of the engines. It possibly took out both of the engines. So the pilots attempted to make an immediate landing, and some reason, somehow, the landing gear was not deployed, so they didn't have wheels and brakes to slow down, but also the flaps were not deployed, and flaps are surfaces at the trailing edge of the wings that seriously or significantly slow down the stall speed of the aircraft to allow it to take off with less runway in order for it to land with less runway. But the reason that was a catastrophe, so there were 181 people on that aircraft and two people survived. The two people that survived were two crew members strapped in right at the rear of the aircraft. And as the tail section separated from the rest of the airframe, they were actually relatively unharmed. But everybody else died because it impacted that large structure. And this is the tragic irony about this incident. And this is why I think it's got important lessons to tell us around managing risks with regards to overshoot. Because what is this thing? Well, this thing is a part of the ILS system, the instrument landing system. It's also got a light array on it, but these systems are designed in order to allow planes to land safely, right? So if it's low visibility, in fact, even if there's zero visibility, this system allows planes to land in situations or circumstances where they would not be allowed to land or be able to land in the absence of it. But of course, by situating it there and putting it in this very large concrete structure, they made a situation which was serious, but potentially survivable, into one that was catastrophic. And of course, a lot of the discussion and the air crash investigation is going to focus on a whole bunch of reasons. One of them, what on earth was this structure doing there? A structure that was meant to be increasing safety actually produced a catastrophic outcome. So we often think about risk in terms of like the Swiss cheese model, right? So if you imagine that you've got slices of Swiss cheese and there's holes in it and you kind of randomly throw them together, it's very unlikely you're going to get a pathway through all those different slices, right? But there are some configurations where there will just be a hole. So in the context of that air disaster, you had the aircraft flew through a flock of birds. You had one of the engines was probably destroyed. potentially the pilot also then shut down the other engine by mistake. There was a failure to deploy the landing gear. There was a failure to deploy the flaps. And all of those things could have been survivable, but it was that last slice, that last element, a long-term planning decision by the airport to situate a concrete bunker at the end of a runway, which made a runway overshoot into a mass fatality. So what's that got to do with climate change? It comes back to this notion of what climate change is and what we're meant to be doing. We go back to 1992. The formation of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. What is the point of this organization? To combat the dangerous interference in the climate system. What has this become? To combat the dangerous unintentional interference in the climate system. We didn't mean to put all these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. With the deliberate or intentional interference. So earlier this year, I contributed to some work. Again, Mandy Bissett was involved, but this was led by Olivia Lazard, and I've done a number of projects with her. When we tried to think about geoengineering risk or the deliberate interference in the Earth system with regards to trying to limit overshoot risks, and there's a number of things that I think are important with some of this work. There are risks involved when we undertake this kind of solar radiation management or any kind of geoengineering risk. The first is that, well, it just doesn't work, right? Or it might even have a counterproductive effect. The second one is that it may cause harm, and certainly some geoengineering will, in terms of air pollution, let's say. Or it could exacerbate international tensions, and I know some of the people most concerned around solar radiation management are most concerned about it because of the geopolitical implications. How are we going to manage the deployment of solar radiation management? What happens when country A deploys a sulfur injection and then country B experiences some kind of extreme weather event? How does that complicate the already very fraught situation of climate change policy negotiations? And the thing with SRM, we always know that there's this thing of termination shock. If you stop it relatively quickly, then its effect fades. And if you haven't reduced emissions in that time, well, then we know that global average temperatures could increase very quickly. I think more importantly, we've got systemic destabilization potentials. And then you've got this notion of overshoot risk. So the new series of risks that are going to be generated because we are now in a period of overshoot. And geoengineering is just one of them, right? Now, some people will argue that you can actually manage these kind of overshoot risks by deploying geoengineering, or there's a compelling reason to do so. So, for example, AMOC shutdown. I just find it astonishing that some of the science is concluding that the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, even on a low emissions trajectory, has got basically a 1 in 5 chance of shutdown, right? Because the consequences of AMOC shutdown is described as a tipping point we must not cross, right? So basically, we need geoengineering to scale up in order to be able to somehow offset these kind of risks. Well, Mandy and I have had some thoughts about that. There might be some compelling reasons to deploy geoengineering, but we need to be more nuanced. I'm not saying we shouldn't under any circumstances, but at the moment, certainly the kind of discourse and analysis that I see is incredibly crude, if not simple-minded. The risk-risk calculus, and that you've got risks of climate change and risks of geoengineering. And basically, if you just kind of wait long enough, the risks of not doing geoengineering would outweigh the risks of unabated climate change, because climate change risks are potentially almost infinite in economic terms, right? We could lose everything if we go beyond 3, 4, or 5 degrees Celsius. So even though there are risks in geoengineering, we will be forced to deploy it. I think that's problematic for a number of reasons. I've been doing some work thinking about, well, what's geoengineering doing? Well, it's getting us to focus on things like constants, stocks and flows, buffers, relatively superficial. I mean, sounds kind of crazy to call it relatively superficial things to address the climate challenge, when really what we could be doing is deeper engagement using kind of Mellow's typology of deeper interactions, because there are systemic problems that we might need to address. But geoengineering, carbon dioxide removal, what's deemed to be policy relevant, is keeping us in this area. I want to briefly show this figure because this shows who's funding geoengineering in the context of carbon dioxide removal. So this is work that's been led by Mandy Bissett. And when I started working with Mandy, I assumed it's oil and gas that, of course, is all over CDR. And it's not. It's big tech. It's the big tech companies. It's in some places the AI boom, which is driving a significant movement of money into what is in many instances startups about carbon dioxide removal. Which leads me finally onto this idea of derailment risk, because with increasing overshoot, we're seeing situations where worsening climate consequences has the potential to destabilize societies, which distracts them from decarbonisation, which is ultimately the thing that we must do to stay safe, which would then worsen climate consequences, destabilise societies, and on and on. It doesn't have to be like that. You can imagine that as climate action increases, it reduces climate impacts. But if climate impacts were to increase, it increases climate action, which is a kind of virtuous circle that we want. But the thing I'm particularly concerned around with overshoot is that climate impacts are going to be degrading our abilities to progress decarbonisation. With increasing impacts, destabilisation, political destabilisation and international conflict. And I think we can already see some of the elements of these emerging. You look at the Valencia floods, the destabilisation, the political destabilisation in Valencia after these devastating floods, which benefited climate-denying right-wing political parties. I do just want to point out, what's another way that we can see these kind of derailment risks? Here is the EPA website, the Environmental Protection Agency, about climate change in October 8th, 2025. Causes of climate change, since the Industrial Revolution, human activities have removed large amounts of carbon dioxide, blah, blah, blah. What does it say now? What are the causes? Natural processes are always influencing the Earth's climate, and it can explain climate change prior. However, recent change cannot be explained by natural causes alone. What does it talk about? Change of the Earth's orbit, variation of solar activity, volcanism, and right at the end, it talks about carbon dioxide concentration. It doesn't even mention emissions or human emissions. Right. This is the level of denial that a political system is now undergoing in order to try to resist the unavoidable consequences of overshoot. So, ways forward. If you don't do this, then I can't really see much point in doing anything else. We've been saying this for 30 years, so obviously that's not sufficient. We also need to transform food systems into carbon sinks. A current driver of climate change is our food systems, and somehow they need to be transformed, maybe through regenerative processes, probably a significant reduction of animal farming and husbandry and agriculture. We need planetary restoration, not just plant a bunch of trees. Natural ecosystems have been regulating carbon for billions of years, and we need to restore the ones that we destroyed. At the same time, we need to accelerate climate change adaptation, because the consequences have already arrived and we can have a massive difference on people's outcome and quality of life through increasing adaptation. And we also need to increase the societal resilience. The energy transition, the sustainability transitions themselves need to be resilient to societal disruption, to the consequence of climate change. And also, I would argue that we need to develop new ways to make polluters pay. Rich industrialized nations are responsible for the climate crisis. They're the ones that should be paying for the loss and damages and the accelerated mitigation that the situation demands. Thank you very much.
From the University of Exeter Global Systems Institute, that was Professor James Dyke. Find links to the video and supporting materials in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Next week, we go into the evil twin of global warming. Humans are making the ocean more acidic, and that changes everything. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Go no further, no further to go. Speed and space, time and place. Got the limit. Birds and bugs, all that swim, tops of trees, state you're in. All you make, all you take, got a limit, brother, got a limit, sister, got a limit. Here we are, trying and crying, love while we can, downtown, down, downtown. Everywhere, every line, at the limit, stop. No further, universe rules, nobody go past it, it's the limit, living at the limit, if you call it that, no matter what you say, here today, at the limit, living large, getting small,